Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of America's Conservative Podcast. I am your host, Ed Dentzel. It's Friday. Beautiful day here in Madeira Beach. I come to the microphone today with a little bit of the sniffles or something going on. Got a little tickling going on in my nose and my sinus area. Probably still some allergies. I've taken some medication before I started doing this podcast, so hopefully you hear that sniff. Hopefully, as I continue on this show, it will go away. Sad news coming out of Pittsburgh yesterday that I don't know what exactly his official title ended up being within the last few years, but Dan Rooney, who was president of the Steelers at one time and still was very instrumental in their organization, he died yesterday. And as I've told you, I'm a big Pittsburgh Steeler fan, Pittsburgh Pirate fan. I grew up in that area. I continue to listen to sports radio from that area. In fact, I listen to Pittsburgh sports radio more than anything else that I listen to. I do listen to some political podcasts, and I like watching disc golf videos on YouTube, and I listen to my Iron Maiden all the time, but probably more than anything, especially this time of the year, I'm listening to Pittsburgh sports radio more than anything. And so that news came out yesterday, sometime in the afternoon, I think. And so Pittsburgh sports radio for the last 12, 18 hours has been covering nothing but that. I have to tell you, though, to be honest, I've never been the biggest fan of the Rooneys. I can't say that I necessarily had anything against Art Rooney Sr., the guy who actually started the Steelers way back in the 1930s, and how he started the Steelers with some money he won at the racetrack, because Art Rooney was a little bit of a gambler. I can't say that I necessarily hold anything against him, but my impression of the Rooneys is twofold. One is somewhat political, and the other one, I guess, isn't so much political, but the truth is this: the Rooneys over the years have kind of, in a way, blackmailed the people in the Pittsburgh area, Allegheny County, and the surrounding areas, frankly. Back in the 90s, they threatened to move the Steelers to some other city if the city didn't pay for a new stadium. Of course, at the time, it was Three Rivers Stadium they were playing in, and essentially, that is how we ended up with Heinz Field for the Steelers, was the issue of a threat. And you should know that none of the money, the Rooneys themselves, have never put any of their own money into building of their own stadiums. In contrast to somebody like Jerry Jones for the Dallas Cowboys, who built the stadium that the Cowboys played in with his own money. And I personally think that this public financing of stadiums is going to kill sports eventually. I don't know how long people are really going to put up with that. So if you're going to tell the whole story about the Rooneys and how good they are, and I have no doubt that they are good to their players. You hear that from all their players. You hear that from players who were playing on other teams, then go to the Steelers, and then they retire. And they'll talk about how playing for the Steelers and how they were treated playing for the Steelers was better than wherever they were. Ike Taylor, who former cornerback for the Steelers, won a couple Super Bowls with them. Good guy. He was very close to Dan Rooney and said what a great man he was and how the Rooneys would come down into the locker room and talk to the players, and some players would say, I played on other teams, I never even saw the owner of the team. So I give the Rooneys credit for that, but when it comes to what the Rooneys have done, in my opinion, against the people of Western Pennsylvania, what they've done, what they did was wrong. And they are not the only ones in professional sports in the United States who have tried that and gotten away with it. How people can continue to be held in very high esteem when essentially they've been blackmailing the people who now speak so well of them. It's a hard situation, a hard circumstance to understand. And I saw that. That's probably, you know, I moved out of the Pittsburgh area in May of 1998. That was before Heinz Field and PNC Park, which was built at the same time for the Pirates. I think they opened in 2001. But one of the last stories I can remember, major stories in the Pittsburgh area before I moved, was all about the future building of those stadiums and how the people of Allegheny County and the area were going to have to pay for it, and the taxes were going to go up, and the Rooneys and the owners of the Pirates weren't going to put any money into these stadiums. And it's a little bit pitiful. And it's just wrong. On top of the fact that I think that I believe those studies that show that having professional sports teams in cities does not really add to the economy as much as everybody thinks, all the money that's sunk into it. It's just simply entertainment that goes into the team and not much else. And that's why it's kind of pleasurable for me to enjoy the Steelers and the Pittsburgh Pirates so far away, and I don't have to deal with any of that stuff. But let's not portray the Rooneys and other sports families who own teams and say how great they are when their expectations that somebody else should pay for the facility that they use. It's a very weird situation that you would not find in any other private business out there. Generally, if McDonald's wants to have a restaurant, they have to build their own building. You know, Dick's Sporting Goods, anything else, they have to build their own with their own money, and they have to pay the taxes on it, and they have to pay for the upkeep and everything else. The Steelers and the Pirates, they just get to use those facilities, and somebody else has to take care of them. That's a pretty nice setup, and I think it's wrong. I really do. So there's that part of it. Then, of course, the political part of it is how much the Rooneys embraced Barack Obama going back to 2008, and then Dan Rooney to the point he became ambassador to Ireland. The Rooneys did not have to get involved in politics. To my knowledge, I don't know of any other sports ownership family that embraced a politician, a major politician, a future president, as much as the Rooneys embraced Barack Obama in 2008. And that also, and you know, of course, what I think of Barack Obama, you know what I think of Democrats. That also makes me suspicious that maybe the Rooneys aren't exactly all that they are made out to be. I'm not saying that the people who work for them and the people who have played for them are liars. But it's pretty clear to me Barack Obama was not a good guy. And then on top of it, I guess you could add this into it, the Rooney Rule, which says that if there is any hiring that is done on an NFL team, that at least one minority person must be interviewed for the position. And the Rooneys have gotten a lot of credit from that. Well, aren't you essentially saying that the rest of the NFL has been racist when you say that? That you have to put into effect a rule where a minority must be interviewed? Isn't that essentially saying that the reason they're not doing it is because they're all racist? They only want to interview white guys? So it's kind of, what is it, self-righteousness that the Rooneys, to me, have always displayed over the years, holier-than-thou kind of stuff. And I really, as a Pittsburgh sports fan, like I said, I grew up there. I was born in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, lived in Leechburg, Pennsylvania until 1998, and then moved. My parents still live in the area in Butler, Pennsylvania. And I always have felt this way. I can't ever remember having a great opinion on the Roonies. I just can't. And I think that I'm in the minority when it concerns the Steelers. I think most Steeler fans like the Roonies and because, you know, the Rooney way and everything else, which is a complete fallacy. The Roonies have looked past their players' problems as much as any other owner of any other team out there. There is no Rooney way. It's all fallacy. And that's this one of those things that I don't like about sports, how people become so myopic and get tunnel vision that nothing is wrong with their team. It's all the other teams are crooked and everything. It's part of sports that I can't stand. And I feel that way. I get that feeling when I see all these people talking about the Roonies and especially regular people. People who have worked for them, players, I don't know that. But for those people who still live in Western Pennsylvania, speak so kindly of the Roonies. I don't get it because all these people have been blackmailed by them for decades. So there's my little rant about that. Maybe you didn't expect that, but maybe some of you have listened to the show for a while. Knowing that I'm a Pittsburgh sports fan, maybe you could expect that I would bring that up on this day after Dan Rooney died at the age of 84. He was a guy who did not age well. I was talking to my dad this morning. My dad's 80 years old. So my dad is only 4 years younger than Dan Rooney. And my dad is surely in better physical condition than Dan Rooney is. My dad is 80 years old, still has good posture, can walk around, can get up, sit up and sit down, still does a little work outside of the house where my parents live in Pennsylvania. You know, he could climb the stairs up into the attic of their house, which I worry about. And then I look at Dan Rooney, and I don't know what kind of affliction he had, but he was all hunched over. I was asking my dad, is that arthritis or is it osteoporosis? I don't know. But it seemed to really grasp him late in his life, made him, frankly, look a little weird. So, but he did not age well. Something really kicked in there. And I'm sure it was, maybe that was a factor in his death. I don't know what the cause of death was. So let's move on to something else. I got to give it to Assad, leader of Syria. See, this is what we're going to talk about here is what I was afraid of regarding Donald Trump and his embracing of conspiracy theories for his own ends, because these other leaders of these countries, specifically the ones that aren't friendly with the United States, they read the news too. They follow presidential campaigns. They have opposition research. They have intelligence services. These leaders have people whose job it is to analyze who's going to be president of the United States, figure out his weaknesses and his strengths, and whatever else. And probably on top of that, trying to, you know, put spies inside Washington, D.C. That's what these other countries' jobs are. And Assad has obviously been doing his homework regarding all of this. And he did an interview with some organization over there. And I got this interview from Sana.si, so it's an English-speaking, English-language Syrian website. That's where the .si comes, S-Y, I should say. Sana, S-A-N-A, .S-Y, so for Syria. He did this interview, and first off, I need to say that Assad is saying that this was a false flag operation. Who does that sound like? Do you think that false flag are two words that are used in Syria? No, I don't know what the major language is in Syria. It's not English, but I understand that Assad speaks it. He lived in England for all those years, and he was a dentist or something before he went back to Syria to become leader. So he speaks English, his wife speaks English, and I'm sure there are people, other lots of English-speaking people in that country, but I'm going to say that a lot of people there don't speak English, but false flag is not a word that I would think that a foreigner speaking English in another country would know. That seems to be a very American English word. Something that the idea, of course, the idea maybe didn't start here, but I think those words were created here. But here we have the leader of Syria using those two words, and I'm telling you, that's not by mistake. That is a plan. That is a plan. He's saying that he did not drop those chemical weapons on those people. That was actually done by their own people to make him look bad. I doubt that is the case sitting here. But it doesn't matter what I think. It only matters what the United States, the leaders think, Donald Trump and others think. But the problem, and maybe the reason that Assad is doing this, is you know what president in American history really loves conspiracy theories? Yep, you got it. Donald Trump. Donald Trump. There hasn't been a major conspiracy theory in the last 15 years that Donald Trump hasn't latched onto. Whether it be Bush caused 9/11 and blaming Bush for what happened and going with along with all those truthers to the birth certificate controversy, which is another big conspiracy of the last 10 years. Barack Obama actually isn't an American citizen. Actually, he was born in Kenya, and he's not an American citizen, so he can't be president. Even more recently, Ted Cruz's dad had something to do with the assassination of JFK. So not only just saying that Ted Cruz's dad had something to do with the assassination, but essentially saying that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald who by himself killed JFK. It was a conglomeration of people put together who did this. Once again, getting into another conspiracy theory. And so it should, after all of that, it shouldn't then be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised that then Assad is going to go right back at Donald Trump and say, well, hey, he believes in conspiracy theories. He wants to believe in conspiracy theories. Here, I'll give him a conspiracy theory. This is exactly one of the things that I was fearful of in all of this. And I believe that is one part of Donald Trump's weakness. Because, you know, I think there is part of Donald Trump who can't resist stuff like that. I'm not even saying necessarily that he believes Bush in 9/11 or Barack Obama or Ted Cruz. It's all for effect. It's all a means to an end. And so it's in a way Assad is trying to relate to Donald Trump in this way and trying to make Donald Trump really question what he's going to do regarding Syria from now on. In addition, this is another sign that Assad's people have been watching American television. In this interview, he used the word deep state. And that's another word that comes from the United States, especially within the last few months, being that that's been thrown around quite a bit. And this also feeds into those people who have been those hardcore Trump supporters, the Alex Jones types. And you could even say, going back to false flag, there hasn't been a person who's used the word false flag more in the last 15 years in American media than Alex Jones. And in a way, it kind of sounds like Assad and his people know who Alex Jones is too, kind of feeding into those people's, Alex Jones and those types of people's paranoia. And trying to say that this chemical attack was done by the rebels' own people and killing their own people. Or to the fact that maybe even this chemical attack never even happened and it was all just fake acting. Well, what does that remind you of? I know exactly what I thought of first when Assad in this interview said that these kids really didn't suffer. This really didn't even happen. I thought of the Sandy Hook shooting. Well, who was on the cutting edge of that controversy and the conspiracy regarding the Sandy Hook shooting? Alex Jones. Alex Jones, a huge Donald Trump supporter. And see, this is the way that I say that Assad is really trying to really goad on Donald Trump, because it seems that Assad understands way more about Donald Trump than I think Donald Trump understands about Assad and the situation over there and what he really wants to do about it. And then getting back to the deep state, that's another term that the kooks have been using, that there's people within the intelligence community are running this rogue war. And essentially what Assad is saying in this interview, that you know, these regimes change, people change, presidents change and everything, but that deep state stays there. And what he's essentially saying is that Donald Trump really doesn't have control over his own country. And that's not how we think of things in the United States. The president doesn't control the country. We are not ruled. We are governed. We are led. But he doesn't control us. But that's essentially what Assad is saying, that really Trump has no control over what these people are doing, and he's just a figurehead, and no matter if the president's changed, there's always going to be those people in there who want to do this and who want to do that. And really getting, you could say, at Donald Trump's ego. And he certainly knows where to hit Trump, I think, where it hurts. But in addition, he knows how to talk to Trump, even though they're not necessarily talking to each other face to face, in a way that feeds into Trump's ego at the same time and the behavior that Trump has displayed in the past. Once again, given these conspiracy theories that Trump seems so easily to latch onto at a moment's notice when he really didn't have to. So it's a very interesting situation, and, you know, we're going to see what happens here. Of course, Assad is saying that he doesn't have chemical weapons and he didn't use these chemical weapons, and there's some rumors out there that there was some communiques that were found that were intercepted saying that the Russians knew that what Assad was going to do with these chemical weapons before it happened. We're going to see how all of this shakes out. But Assad, I get the feeling, is no dummy. And I think that, you know, this is something with Donald Trump. And see, this was what was probably so frustrating during the campaign, is that, at least to me, Donald Trump has a huge glass jaw. And that is his ego, that is his pride. And nobody was able to undermine it, was never able to hit it. Some guys gave it some shots. Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, among others, gave it a shot. They couldn't do it. And that was their fault. That's not Donald Trump's fault. That's their fault that they couldn't do it. Maybe they didn't quite understand what was going on with Donald Trump. Maybe they were a little too nice. We can analyze the Republican primary for 2016, and I'm sure political scientists will be doing that from now to the end of time on what everything that happened there. But very quickly, it seems like the leader of a nation, you know, halfway around the world, has a better idea of how to talk to Donald Trump, how to egg him on, how to bother him better than anybody, any of those Republican nominees could. Any of those other candidates could. And feeding into Donald Trump's desire for conspiracy and things like that. So we're going to see how this plays out. But I know, that, and this is something that you should be watching, is that anytime you ever hear any of these foreign leaders using words like deep state and false flag, you should automatically know that they have been studying American media. That is not something that they are, those words, they are not using them by accident, because those words in their own language, like in Russian or Arabic, whatever they speak in Syria, those words I'm not sure mean anything in those languages, but they do mean something in English. And the only place that they would get those words from, those phrases from, is from the United States. And they know exactly what they're doing when they say it. They really do. And this is supposed to give pause to Donald Trump before he goes any further. And it because Donald Trump is so eager to wear his heart on his sleeve and display where his weaknesses are and exactly what he's thinking. And, you know, the thing about Donald Trump, and this is probably good and bad, there are no secrets with him. He has no filter, whether it's on Twitter or in person. You find out very quickly exactly, you figure out very quickly what exactly he's feeling and thinking. And that can be a very positive, and people can find that refreshing sometimes, not just in politics, but in our everyday lives. But it also can be a detriment when you're dealing with people who want to get over on the United States. When you have a president that expresses exactly what he's thinking and what's going on behind the scenes, people eventually are going to figure out how to use that against him. Wasn't able to be done in the primary season, but I think that these leaders of these other countries, China, North Korea, Iran, Syria, Russia, leaders of ISIS, they're going to figure out pretty quickly that all they have to do is listen to Donald Trump, and they're going to figure out all the things they need to do. And they're going to figure out what the weaknesses are of this man. They are, because he's just a little, sometimes you could say a little too honest and a little too out there, a little too vocal. And then you add on top of that his ego and his desire to be seen as the strong man and the smartest man in the room could drive him to make decisions that he shouldn't be making. And once again, we'll see what happens. Now, who knows? Assad might not even be in power a year from now. Who knows what's going to happen? But speaking of that, let's move to that topic a little bit here before the break. I was reading this article at hotair.com that National Security Advisor McMaster, who is the guy that took Mike Flynn's spot, McMaster is allegedly for putting boots on the ground in Syria. Now, you'll remember just a couple days ago on this very same show, America's Conservative Podcast, I told you a story about how Donald Trump says, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going in. That was his words. We're not going into Iraq, into Syria, which means we're not putting American soldiers, Marines on the ground there. Now you're hearing from his national security advisor that may not be the case at all. Now, if you're wondering how many people we're talking about, it varies. In that same story, there was a mention of 10,000 people, the American military, on the ground in Syria. But there was also a report that was sourced by two different sources that number could rise to as high as 50,000, 50,000 troops in Syria. Now, I want to ask you, what the heck are we doing? What are they doing? Is this a fake out? Is this just a rumor? Is this just something to make Assad worried that, you know, he should behave himself or do whatever? Or is this actually real? I want to get into that after the break. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.
The voice of American conservatism, WRS Digital, Red State Talk Radio.
And we are back at America's Conservative Podcast. I'm going to continue to talk about these prospects of possibly American troops going into Syria. You should know that Mike Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, who of course had to resign due to his conversations with the Russians that he wasn't honest to his bosses about, Flynn was absolutely 100% against sending troops into Syria at any cost because of what he understood what was going on there. And he's more of I wouldn't necessarily say an isolationist, but he didn't see the fruits of doing that. I'm not saying that Mike Flynn wouldn't have gone along with the cruise missiles or whatever else, but certainly on the record, Mike Flynn was against putting troops in Syria. So there is an idea out there, being that Mike Flynn had to resign and he's no friend of McMaster, that there could be that Flynn's out there behind the scenes airing this news that troops may be sent to Syria because he thinks that it may undermine McMaster, because I think the idea in the United States is that, I don't know, you know, the American people are a little suspicious about sending troops in there, even if it is Trump as president, and even though we did shoot missiles into there. And so Flynn might be a little bit of payback on his part in doing this. There is that story, and that's part of this hot air story. I don't know about that. I don't know. I think that's stretching things a little bit far, and I think this sounds to me like somebody somewhere trying to once again put the blame somewhere else, when really, if this administration is making mistakes, it's making mistakes all on its own. It's not some outside influence or, you know, somebody outside the administration who's trying to undermine it. They're hurting themselves all on their own. And as I was listening to a recent podcast, I think it was the Commentary Magazine podcast, maybe not the most recent one, but maybe the one before that, and the administration complaining about leaks to the media and everything, and John Podoretz, I think it was, on this podcast, was saying it's Trump's own people who were leaking this stuff, and everybody knows it. They're doing this on purpose. They'll do the leaking to make the media look bad, and then they'll complain about the leaks. And if that's the case, that I think that just shows you how horrible this administration is and how manipulative. But you shouldn't be surprised by this, given that this administration is led by a guy who, as I talked about in the first half, loves a conspiracy theory and loves to create these false stories and create idea news that isn't news. I guess you could say fake news, dare I say it. So you have this situation in Syria, rumors about going in there with troops, 10,000 up to 50,000, all because of a civil war. And fighting a guy in Assad who is a bad guy. But I think if it's going to be this make America great again and America first, you know what's best for Americans? That Assad stays in power. I know that he's friends with Russia. I know all that. That's not going. I don't think that's going to change. I mean, are we really trying to say that if Assad was thrown out of power by whatever means, whether it's, you know, 10,000 troops or one troop and an assassination or 50,000, 100, whatever the case may be. If the opposition, these people who were just gassed a week ago, however long ago, 10 days ago, if one of their leaders was to get into power, do we really believe he or she would be a friend of the United States? Do we really believe that would be a country that would be on our side? And how do you think the Russians would feel about that? I think given every total scenario, realistic scenario out there, the best situation for the United States is for Assad to stay in power. Give Assad his country. Let him be friends with the Russians. I don't know what you can do about that now. I think the concern now, if I were president, is I would stay out of Syria. I wouldn't have sent any cruise missiles in there or anything. I wouldn't help Assad. I wouldn't hurt Assad. What's going to happen there is going to happen there. My concern as president of the United States would be make sure that Russia doesn't set one foot outside of that country, not into Iraq, not into Lebanon, not into anywhere, Saudi Arabia, anywhere, ever. That would be my concern. I would just say, Vladimir Putin, you know what? You want to get mixed up in that civil war and you want to sink resources and all that, good luck. But here's, have this as our understanding. You're not going anywhere else. And we'll be watching. I know that we in Turkey haven't been on the best terms the last few years. But don't think about messing around with them. Don't think about messing around with Israel. Don't think about messing around in Iraq. You don't think about messing around in Saudi Arabia or any of these countries. We already don't like that you're friends with Iran and doing things there. Well, you know what? We're going to do you know what we're going to do. I don't have to tell you. You know how I think about Iran. You know what I think. You know, I don't have to tell you. You know, if you want to defeat ISIS, then we could talk about that. You want to stop terrorism around the world? I think we can work together on that. But don't think that you're going to be going into any of these other places in the United States and set up in the Middle East and set up bases. That is not happening. If you have that plan, I would stop thinking about it right now. I think that's the best you can do right now with this. I think what the United States has to do regarding all of this in Syria is you have to wait. Vladimir Putin is not going to live forever. And if I was president, I'd be making sure that the State Department, whoever, NSA, CIA, whoever else, start looking at Russian politics and start figuring out who probably the next leader is going to be and start planning 20 years from now or 10 years from now, what is Russia going to look like? Is the person going to be even worse than Putin? Is this person going to be better than Putin? I would be wanting those forecasts on my desk as president within the next couple months. In the meantime, I would let Putin and Assad do whatever they wanted in that country. That's what I would do. With the understanding they're not going anywhere else. And if they want to work together with us on ISIS and stopping terrorism, we're more than willing to head up the task force. But that's about, you know, we're going to work together. But don't think that we're going to have Russian jets landing in Iraq, landing in Saudi Arabia or anything. That's not happening. That's what I would do. And I know, though, that it seems like too many of the American people have seen these pictures coming out of Syria. If we are to believe that Assad gassed those people, that I told you about the conversation I had with my mother last weekend, that she thought it was right us sending those cruise missiles in there just because of some children crying on TV. The United States does not determine its diplomatic friends and allies and enemies. It doesn't depend on the crying of children. That is not a standard. If that was the case, we would be bombing every single country in Africa. And we would have bombed North Korea several times over by this point. That is not the standard. So that's my plan. So I don't want anybody to listen to this program and think that all I do is complain. That would be my plan. I don't know all of the intelligence or anything like that, but that seems like a pretty simple one. There may be some maneuvering that we need to do and everything to draw out some lines that Russian can't cross and all that. But I would certainly stay out of Syria. Certainly. Let's move on to something else. There was two conflicting stories that have come out, and you don't know which one to believe right at this second. NBC News came out with a story, was it this morning or late last night, that says the United States is planning a preemptive strike on North Korea. And the conditions are that if it looks like North Korea, excuse me, the sniffles have gone away, but now I'm burping. If North Korea looks like it's going to set off another nuclear test, that the United States, the Dow has assets in the area. We talked about the Carl Vinson aircraft carrier and its group being in the area now. Will launch some sort of attack into North Korea, probably with cruise missiles as well, just like Syria, and take out this test or take out whatever they want to take out and destroy before this test happens. NBC News reported this. And then just a couple hours later, virtually every other news organization in the United States, and that includes both the more liberal ones like CNN and the not so liberal ones, you could say, like Fox News, are now saying that that report, that first report of a preemptive strike, is totally, totally false. And people coming out from the State Department, other places, saying that that is not true, and that's very dangerous for them to say that. That I don't know where they got that information. Now, who to believe? Who to believe? Is it possible that there was just somebody who gave a source to NBC News that lied to them or wanted to get something started by starting the story? Or was this person telling the truth? I'm trying to get in the, pretend to be in the Trump White House. And that, as you know, is difficult for me. I'm going to say this. If it's just a nuclear test, and North Korea has done some nuclear tests before. If it is just a nuclear test within their own borders, I have a hard time understanding why we would do a preemptive strike for that. I would not understand that. It's not. I know they're not supposed to be doing them. I get that. They're not supposed to have nuclear weapons in the first place, but I think it's a little too late to talk about that. But just a test, it's not something, it's not a missile being shot at Japan or South Korea or anybody else. It's not a missile being shot at that carrier group out in the waters to the east of North Korea. If it's they're just doing a test, why you would want a preemptive strike that's going to destroy buildings and labs and people and everything before this is hard to understand. I know we don't like that they're testing. We don't want them to do it. But a preemptive strike, that sounds, even in the Trump White House, a little bit crazy. Because you have to remember that if we are to draw anything we learned from the Syria missile attack, is that the United States waited until something actually happened where people were killed before we did anything. It's not like we just picked a day of the week and said, hey, let's shoot missiles into Syria today. That's not what happened. Whatever you believe, whether Assad gassed those people or they gassed themselves, we wait until something like that happened to do anything. I think that that is would have to be the standard with North Korea as well. So necessarily wouldn't be a preemptive strike. I think that the United States, even with Donald Trump as president, is still under the idea that if we're going to do anything against North Korea, that they're going to have to do something fairly provocative where people were killed before we would do anything. And so just shooting some missiles out into the water that just happened to be in the direction of Japan. And of course, that was what, a couple months ago, they said they were shooting. The missiles were on the in the direction of the military bases in Japan. I don't know, frankly, if North Korea has the technology to even shoot a missile that could hit an American base in Japan. It might, they may be able to hit Japan, the island. They'll hit a land eventually, but be so precise as to hit an American base, I have some doubts about that. I have some doubts. So, but I think, all, on the other hand, they would be able to shoot a missile into South Korea, just point a missile south, and just happen to land anywhere in South Korea, not necessarily in Seoul or any Busan or any big city where there would be a lot of casualties. I think North Korea has the capability of doing that. I think that that's what the United States would have to wait for before it started lobbing missiles or started doing anything about North Korea. At this point, this would not be a long-term fix or anything, because, you know, when I've talked about North Korea in the past, and I've talked about that country several times, I'm particularly fascinated by North Korea, just like I have this fascination with East Germany. I don't like those countries, but I find it interesting to read about them, watch videos about them, and what we can, as conservatives who believe in the human rights and civil rights, Bill of Rights, free markets, free enterprise, private property, everything, what can we learn from those countries that have gone so radically the opposite way? What can we learn? That's why I think that stuff fascinates me. And so when I've talked about North Korea in the past, my idea is a long-term solution to the point where North Korea can be disbanded peacefully. Peacefully. I don't know if that's possible, but that's always the goal. And that's why I've always talked about, well, we're going to have to figure out some way to deal with China and convince them that it's in all of our best interest that North Korea not exist anymore. Anything would be better than the way North Korea is right now. Now, but that's a long-term solution. But what we're talking about here with a preemptive strike or waiting until North Korea does something against another country is going to bring this to a head very quickly, because the way I would think of it is, if North Korea were to do something like that, shoot a missile into South Korea, people get killed, shoot a missile into Japan and get killed, it would be on, to use a saying from like the 1980s or the 1990s, well, it's on now. You know, it's on, meaning there would be a major military conflict, and it would go much further than us just doing some strike with cruise missiles into North Korea. I think it would be decidedly more than, I mean, if we're shooting 60 missiles into Syria because Assad gassed essentially his own people, then how many missiles are we going to shoot into North Korea when they're attacking another country and allies of ours, citizens of countries that are our allies, get killed? How many missiles is it going to be? 80? 120? 1,000? So at that point, when you start thinking about that in those terms, you know that it's going to be something very serious. And there will be no peaceful resolution. And there will be no getting together with China, even though that would be nice. It would be on right away. Really, because I don't think, you know, and this is why I've always said that, you know, we needed to handle this in a diplomatic way, in a peaceful way, getting together with those countries in the region, because the point is that I really don't think China gives a dang if North Korea shoots a missile into South Korea. I think that they'd have sanctions against them and everything else, but China and South Korea are not allies. They're not. they get along. Of course, South Korea is not pleased what China's doing in the South China Sea with the base, that island that turned into a military base and everything. They aren't friends, but they aren't necessarily enemies either. If North Korea shoots a missile and kills some people in Japan, don't expect China to come to the defense of Japan either. The Chinese and the Japanese still hate each other going way back to World War II. And that's why I've always said that I think that we needed to all get together before bullets and missiles started to fly, because that's the only way you're going to be able to keep it all together. Whereas once the missiles and bullets start flying and North Korea is attacking, does something against South Korea or Japan, China's not going to care about that too much, at least except to say, oh, well, you know, North Korea, they're just so crazy. Because those countries had, China has no loyalty to South Korea and Japan. And China instead sees North Korea as a friend, even as kooky as it is, because China doesn't want that whole area. If North Korea were to change and say North Korea became like South Korea, then China starts looking at its whole entire eastern border as being friendly in the United States. And I don't know if China would be happy with that. And that's why I've said that whatever solution that needs to happen with North Korea has to be something where North Korea turns into a country that doesn't have to be South Korea, doesn't have to be the United States, doesn't have to be Japan. What it has to be is maybe another version. I could live with North Korea being a version of China or some country like that, that doesn't have some wacko person leading it. It's not a cult of personality. The people are totally insulated from the rest of the world to the point they don't know anything about anything. Anything better than what North Korea is right now would be good. It's just, how do you get there? How do you get there? And I hope that we're not planning a preemptive strike just because North Korea is going to do a nuclear test. On the other hand, if North Korea does do something against Japan or South Korea, I don't know how the United States can just sit there and not do anything. It's going to do something, and it's going to be pretty severe. And then all that those ideas about us all working together to fix North Korea peacefully go away. And this is why I've continued to say, the longer this goes on, the harder it's going to fix in a way that's not going to get people killed. And I think that in 2017, you're seeing what I've predicted about North Korea for a while. It's coming to fruition, I think. One more thing before I leave you for the weekend. There's nothing funnier. Democrats are saying that Jared Kushner needs to lose his security clearance because he didn't I don't know how this all works, but you know, you have to fill out so much paperwork and you have to do background checks and everything before people get positions in the White House or other places, or you get security clearance, that Jared Kushner did not reveal some of his connections to Russian businessmen or something like that. And so they're saying that Jared Kushner needs to lose his security clearance. Do these Democrats not realize that Jared Kushner is a Democrat just like they are? That the best thing that can happen for Democrats at this point is to have Ivanka and Jared Kushner in the White House, you know, counseling Donald Trump. That is the best thing that can happen for the Democrats right now. And here they are. They want one of their own to lose national security clearance. That's pretty funny. But I got to go. You can find me at edwarddensel.com. You can find this program Monday through Friday, now 2 a.m. Eastern, on Red State Talk Radio. I know it's a weird time, but it works. You can find this program on Podomatic and iTunes. And then my other show, Unfound, new episode coming out today. I hope you'll check it out at Podomatic and iTunes. Follow me on Twitter, Unfound Podcast or USA Podcast. I got to go. Have a great weekend. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.